Próximo programa, The International Radio Report.
Stay tuned to CKUT. Next, The International Radio Report.
Tengan todos ustedes un feliz domingo.
Have a happy Sunday.
Las vacunas.
IRRR listeners, there's another program, World of Radio, now well over 2,000 weekly editions, with multiple broadcasts on two major shortwave stations in the U.S., WRMI and WBCQ. Also IRRS in Europe and Unique Radio in Australia. There are several chances to hear me, Glenn Hauser, on Sunday evenings, among others, and podcasts on demand. Full schedule info plus loads of other material, especially about shortwave, at worldofradio.com.
Welcome, everyone, to the International Radio Report on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. My name's Sheldon. I am here with Jill. We thank you for joining us today. It's our weekly half-hour news and information program about the world of radio. We are in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, for our listeners around the world who may be tuning in on online. You can reach us by email, radioreport@yahoo.com. If you're catching our live streaming or the show archived, it's at ckut.ca. We have a Facebook group as well. We invite you to join International Radio Report, and we welcome Patrick and Anthony to the Facebook group this week. And our latest edition, of course, the YouTube channel, where you can go as quickly as an hour after the program airs on Sunday morning on CKUT and pick up the YouTube audio/video version of the show on the YouTube channel. Look for International Radio Report. We're hoping to have a unique ID on the channel shortly. We'll keep you informed of that. But in the meantime, you can find us by searching for International Radio Report. And other than that, we thank everyone that contributed to the funding drive. It is wrapped up again for this year. We gave you all the details on that last year. The key right now is to make sure you pay your pledge if you haven't done so already. It's nice to make a pledge, but you have to honor it as well. So if you were not doing it online and you have to send in a check or whatever, please make sure you do that. It's most important to get all of that wrapped up. So again, we thank you all who contributed. As we're recording today's show, we have received earlier this morning the news of the passing of Prince Philip. This will obviously provide some interesting radio listening, we think, from the BBC in particular. I'm sure the World Service will be covering this wall to wall, probably for days, maybe weeks to come. So if you are able to pick up the BBC World Service, you may want to check that out. Some of you, we know, have a local BBC relay, maybe on an FM channel in your city, or you maybe have an HD channel on one of your existing stations. So you may want to check all of that. And I'm sure other countries around the world will have special features as well. So that will be something to look for as in the way of special programming coming up over the next little while to mark the passing of Prince Philip. So we move on to today's news. We have stories from a number of different spots. We begin in the United States with a look at the situation with the number of radio stations in the United States. U.S. commercial FM station count is down, and AM numbers continue to shrink. This comes from Radio World. The pandemic has hit radio stations everywhere. Canada is no different. The number of licensed FM commercial stations in the United States hit a historical peak just 15 months ago and has been declining slightly since. That's one of the findings of an analysis by Radio World of the latest station count data from the Federal Communications Commission. We also found the number of AM stations is at its lowest in decades, while the number of NCE FMs has hit a record high, as has the number of FM translators and boosters. The tally of commercial FMs has been rising steadily over several decades. In 1990, when the FCC public data reporting became more consistent, there were about 4,350 commercial FM stations in the country. 10 years later, and 4 years after the 1996 Telecom Act, where there were close to 6,000 commercial FM stations. And by the end of 2019, that number stood at 6,772. But each of the five quarterly reports from the FCC since has shown a slight ebbing. And at the end of March, the number of commercial stations was down to 6,682, or 90 fewer than 15 months ago. Whether we can read any general decline in demand for commercial FM stations into these numbers is problematic. It's a drop of only 1.3% since the peak, though it is notable that the trend line has been virtually all upwards over many years prior. And the FCC doesn't provide analysis of its data. Any shift could be driven by a slowing economy and, of course, the year-long pandemic. It's a number we'll keep an eye on. Meanwhile, a trend in AM station totals is more familiar, and it continues in the latest quarter when the FCC said there were 4,546 AM stations. According to Radio World's analysis, the country's AM station count is the lowest it has been since 1990, and very likely longer than that. In 1990, there were just under 5,000 AM stations, and a total around that period tended not to vary much year to year. But we can say there are now about 9% fewer AM stations than there were in 1990. On the other hand, the number of FM educational stations today is at a historic high at 4,213, which is up 3% over 5 years and double the number at the turn of the century. The number of FM translators and boosters has also hit another record. There are now 8,521 of those, and that's up 30% from just 5 years ago, and more than fourfold from 1990, when there were only about 1,850 translators and boosters. Demand for translators has been helped by multiple factors, including HD radio multicast plays, AM revitalization, and general demand for FM spectrum. And the number of low-powered FM stations is now 2,114. That number has varied within a narrow range for the past decade.
One thing for sure, there's a lot of competition on the radio. Many stations compete with each other. But my take on this is the AM radio stations are slowly declining, which is just continuing a trend that started quite a while back. But the FM radio stations decline, I think we can't really say there's a decline until after the pandemic is over and we're back to normal, because it could simply be an effect of the pandemic that just, you know, tipped over some of them that were struggling a little more because the money wasn't there.
Yeah, I think that's possible. The AM, I think there's a number of factors involved too. We've talked about it many times. The amount of interference that is out there that makes, in many cases, big cities, makes AM stations difficult to listen to. That I'm sure is having an impact. The cost of running an AM transmitter site, much higher than FM.
Yep.
That's a factor to build into all of this as well. So some of those numbers surprising, some of them, I guess, not so surprising.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have some news about the FCC that is about to vote on foreign programming disclosure rules. This is by John Egerton, Multichannel News via Radio World. The FCC will vote on April 22nd. Open meeting to adopt new disclosure requirements when foreign entities buy airtime on U.S. broadcast outlets. If you are consuming programming broadcast over the public airwaves, you have the right to know who is behind the content, says acting FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel in outlining the agenda. The fact that she has scheduled to vote likely means that she has Republican support, because without it, it would be only a 2-2 tie, and the item would not be adopted. The vote on the initial proposal was unanimous, so this vote is likely to be as well. Foreign governments and their agents can't hold a broadcast license, but Rosenworcel said that foreign governmental entities are increasingly purchasing time on domestic broadcast stations, which is why the FCC is acting. She said under the new sponsorship requirements, broadcasters will have to tell the FCC when a government or its representative leases time. These rules will help to ensure transparency of foreign government-sponsored broadcast content in the United States, she said. The chairwoman did not get into specifics on the item, but the fact that she talked only about domestic broadcast stations and broadcast content suggests the item does not extend to the requirement to cable content, as broadcasters had suggested. The FCC voted unanimously last October to propose the disclosure requirements for broadcast TV and radio content sponsored by foreign governments. The proposed rules require a specific disclosure at the time of broadcast if a foreign governmental entity has paid a radio or television station directly or indirectly to air material, or if the programming was provided to the station free of charge by such an entity as an inducement to broadcast the material. The Biden White House has signaled clear concerns with foreign media content. In February 3rd, Daily Briefing, Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about the White House's position on RT, which is Russia Today. Psaki said she had not spoken with the president about RT, but said it was pretty factual to say the outlet was a Russian propaganda tool. Cable operators and broadcasters agree that the Federal Communications Commission should be careful in making sure viewers know where their video and audio content is coming from, an issue that was taken on new urgency in an age of disinformation campaigns by foreign actors. Definitely, we need to know where everything comes from. If you have something on the air, knowing what government or organization of any kind is behind it, I think is a minimum, because it is true in this era of, you know, fake news we hear everywhere, to be able to make a decision as to what I'm hearing is a good content, a content that I can trust or not, knowing where it comes from, I think is the minimum requirement.
There are a couple stations I know of in the United States, AM broadcast stations, where the Chinese government has purchased 24 hours a day of broadcasting on a station. Yep. And if you've heard some of that programming, if you're not really paying attention, I mean, it's in perfect English, you would have no idea that this is actually Chinese-produced programming. Nope. From the Chinese government. So, I think there's a reason for wanting to do this, to get this information out, to let people know what it is, and to protect against this foreign ownership, because I think we're not far away from that happening. Yeah. Where certain governments would like to purchase 24-hour-a-day radio stations where they could, you know, continue to put out their programming, or be it television stations as well. So I think this is probably not that surprising a step, given, you know, all that's been going on lately with, you know, accusations of tampering from foreign governments and that sort of thing. I guess it all comes in part of that package.
One of the examples is China Radio International, which has several outlets through some AM and FM stations in the U.S.
Definitely.
And yeah. When you listen to China Radio International, I mean, the people that they put on the air don't sound Chinese at all.
No.
You have the impression of listening to a regular English language broadcast that could be technically made in the United States. So I think it's important that rules be put up so we know what we're listening to.
No doubt. No doubt. Our next story is one that broke this week, and for anyone who listens to shortwave regularly, the name of Brother Stair will certainly be familiar to you all. This comes from Live 5 WCSC News in South Carolina. Pastor Ralph Stair has died, better known to many listeners as Brother Stair. The Colleton County coroner said that an evangelist who founded the Overcomer Ministry in the county has died. Ralph G. Stair died of heart failure at his home, according to Coroner Richard Harvey. Harvey said Stair had been under hospice care. His age, though, was not immediately clear. The coroner's office listed Stair as 84, but his Overcomer Ministry, which announced his passing on its website, listed his age at 87 and his time of death as 11:17 p.m. last Saturday. At the time of death, Stair was awaiting trial after being accused of sexually assaulting several women and children at his ministry. He was arrested on December the 18th of 2017 by Colleton County deputies and agents from the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security, the Colleton County Sheriff's Office said. Stair was arrested on 8 warrants, and agents also executed a search warrant at the Overcomer Ministry. The charges from that arrest include 3 counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct, 1 count of assault with the intent to commit criminal sexual conduct first degree, 1 count of kidnapping, 1 count of first-degree burglary, 1 count of second-degree assault, and 1 count of third-degree criminal sexual conduct with a minor. Colleton County Circuit Judge Perry Buckner said Stair's bond at $750,000 on January the 24th, 2018. Stair adamantly denied the allegations against him. The Overcomer Ministry at the time has not announced any funeral plans for Brother Stair. So a controversial figure for many reasons. Yeah. We certainly hear his broadcasts on many U.S.-based shortwave radio stations. And it sparked a lot of discussion. Some people wondering what the impact's going to be on the broadcasts, the existing broadcasts. What the impact will be on the radio stations that do broadcast his programming. And then the other side of the coin, what he was awaiting trial on, and his accusers that, were scheduled to get their day in court, and he was supposed to get his day in court. And of course, that now is not going to happen.
One thing for sure, the impact is going to be the future of shortwave broadcasting with U.S. private stations. Now, is there a way that they are going to continue this broadcast? There's Dr. Gene Scott that we hear on shortwave that's been dead for a while now, and that still continues to be aired. Money's still getting in. So is the Overcomer Ministry, does it have some plan of being able to continue? If it does, then maybe nothing's going to change for now. But in the event of having the Overcomer Ministry disappear from the shortwave stations, especially shortwave stations like WRMI, WWCR, and WBCQ, this might be a big change coming up for shortwave broadcasting in the U.S. because that money is going to be gone. That money is a big part of their budget. I mean, remove that, I'm sure you remove more than half of all the money that's coming into these stations.
Yeah, given the amount of time that the ministry was purchasing from these stations, I'm not sure the dollar figure, obviously, but like you said, it's probably a substantial amount of their annual revenue coming from one of the major sources. So how that's going to play out in the end, like you said, Dr. Gene Scott kept his broadcast going, many years after his death. There were recordings made and they just kept, producing these things and putting them out there. Whether that's going to happen with the Brother Stair broadcasts and the Overcomer Ministry, the ministry still exists. So whether will somebody else pick up the ball? I think he had a son, is it, that possibly, I think is, yeah. That they've mentioned that, could possibly take things over. So who knows? Maybe that will continue. We'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I heard a figure somewhere that he had something like 97 hours of programming on shortwave.
Wow.
So that's a lot of time. And, if that goes away, I personally think it's fine. But where it stands is what's going to happen with U.S. broadcasters mostly.
Yeah, for sure. We have an anniversary come up, 20th anniversary of something that's important to shortwave listeners.
Yes, and actually that could have turned into a real disaster if it had happened in a different way. So 20 years ago, an extreme geomagnetic storm happened. This is by Dr. Tony Phillips, Space Weather Archive. What a difference 20 years makes. Today the sun is blank and featureless as solar cycle 25 struggles to pull solar activity from the doldrums of a deep solar minimum. In March 2001, however, the solar disk was peppered with sunspots, including a monster named AR9393. The biggest sunspot of solar cycle 23 was a truly impressive sight, visible to the naked eye at sunset and crackling with X-class solar flares. On March 29, 2001, the sunspot hurled a pair of CMEs directly towards the Earth. The first one struck during the early hours of March 31, 2001. The leading edge of the shock front was dense and strongly magnetized, traits that give rise to powerful geomagnetic disturbances. Within hours, an extreme geomagnetic storm was underway, registering to a maximum of G5 on the scale of NOAA storm scales, which is G1 to G5. It's the maximum value. I was fortunate to witness and photograph the event when I was just a teenager, recalls Lukas Gornjestic, who watched the show from Medicine Hat, Alberta. In the hours that followed, northern lights spread as far south as Mexico, and 20-year-old notes Dr. Tony Phillips of spaceweather.com describes red and green auroras dancing for hours over the Sierra Nevada mountains of California at latitude plus 37 degrees. Similar displays were seen in Houston, Texas, Denver, Colorado, and San Diego, California. Here in Payson, Arizona, red curtains and green streamers were pulsating all across the sky, wrote Dan Schur when she submitted a picture to spaceweather.com 20 years ago. "We have seen some auroras before, but this display was really special," she wrote. A second CME struck at 22 hours UT on March 31st, but instead of firing up the storm, the impact quenched it. When the CME passed Earth, the interplanetary magnetic field surrounding our planet suddenly turned north, a unfavorable direction for geomagnetic activity. Indeed, the quenching action of the second CME may have saved power grids and other technological systems from damage. The storm's intensity stopped just short of the famous March 14, 1989 event that caused the Quebec blackout and was only a fraction of the powerful Carrington event of 1859. The old episode lasted barely 24 hours. It was brief, but intense. If you want to see some of those things, go to spaceweather.com, and on the right side of the page, you have the ability to go back in time, choose a date for viewing what the content was on the Space Weather site at that time. You just go back to March 30th, 31st, and April 1st, 2001, and I went there. There's a lot of impressive photos. And signs of the times, most of the pictures were taken on film because in 2001, digital cameras and smartphone cameras were not yet very popular and not very good anyways at the time. So I actually witnessed the geomagnetic storm of that 2001 event. And I remember I called my brother. My brother called some friends, and I called another friend that was up north. And it was so intense that even in Montreal, which is a difficult place for auroras because of the light pollution, it was easy to view. And even my friend called me back the next day, said, "Thank you so much for calling me to let me know this. It was so amazing up north to see all of this. It was just great." And that was an amazing display. And I think it's the last time I've seen a display of auroras, actually.
Yeah, I actually saw a brief view of these red and green like streamers, like these. They looked like straight lines coming right down through the sky, and brilliant color of red and green. I remember seeing and not really understanding at the time exactly what I was seeing, and then I realized, oh yeah, one of these storms is going on.
Yep.
So it's you know, how vulnerable we are. Had this been a little bit stronger and you know, closer to that Carrington event, and we would have been in big trouble for sure.
Absolutely. Talking about space weather, well, we've have some really quiet conditions. It really doesn't resemble at all what happened at that time. The sun is blank today, and we had a sunspot that lasted a few days. a little bit of unsettled conditions on Monday and Tuesday, but overall it was pretty good. I had some really nice moments of listening to shortwave this week with a lot of signals, lots of interesting stuff to listen to. There is a coronal hole that might actually give a solar wind that will be flowing and reach the Earth on April 11th today, so that might degrade reception a little bit. Solar flux is at 74, 75. K-index has been hovering at 1 or 2, which is quiet. So, of course, conditions a little unsettled maybe today, but quiet conditions shouldn't be too bad. Turn on that radio. It's the best you can do.
This is John Fisher of North Chelmsford, Massachusetts. I listen to the International Radio Port every Sunday morning at 10:30 on CKUT 90.3 FM in the fair city of Montreal.
We will wrap up today's show as usual, giving you previews of the upcoming ham radio contest for next weekend. And there's some really interesting ones here and some unique ones. We start with the Holy Land DX contest, 2100 to April 16th to 2100 April 17th. All of these times that we give are UTC times for these contests. Sponsored by the Israeli Amateur Radio Club, the aim is to promote contacts between radio amateurs around the globe and Israeli hams, and to aid amateurs to achieve the Holy Land Award. And there are certificates and awards for this contest, which you'll find out about on the website. The modes are CW, SSB, and digital, 160 through 10 meters, and there are no work bans for this contest.
There's the ES Open HF Championship from 05 Zulu to 0859 Zulu, April 17th. This is sponsored by the Estonian Radio Amateurs Union. CW and SSB bands 80 and 40 meters simultaneously. Recommended. There are some recommended frequencies for CW and SSB that you'll be able to see on the links that we will post.
This is a contest next that I've not seen before, and this might be really challenging, but really interesting and rewarding if you have some success with it and if propagation is good. Worked All Provinces of China DX Contest. 600 Zulu, April 17th to 0559 Zulu, April 18th. Sponsored by the Mulan DX Club. The contact objective is to contact as many as possible amateurs in Chinese provinces, municipal cities, autonomous regions, and special administration regions. It is 80 through 10 meters, CW, SSB, and mixed CW and SSB modes. I'm not quite sure what that is, but sounds interesting. And there's not a lot of Chinese hams that we hear on the air. Propagation needs to be good to get to them as well. So give that one a shot. It might be really, really rewarding.
There's the YUDX contest, 07 Zulu, April 17th to 0659 Zulu, April 18th, sponsored by the Amateur Radio Association of Serbia. And it's 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters. Calling CQ is forbidden in DX segments of the bands. And, of course, the modes are CW and SSB.
The CWJF group in Brazil is sponsoring the CQMMDX contest, 0900 Zulu, April 17th, 2359 Zulu, April 18th. It is CW only, and it is 80 through 10 meters.
We have the Michigan QSO party, 16 Zulu, April 17th to 04 Zulu, April 18th. Sponsored by the Mad River Radio Club. The object is for amateurs outside the state of Michigan to make contact with as many Michigan stations as possible. Non-Michigan stations may work only Michigan stations, while Michigan stations may contact anyone. So it's CW and SSB on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters.
And finally, here in Canada, we have the Ontario QSO party, 1800 Zulu the 17th of April to 1800 Zulu the 18th, sponsored by the Ontario Contest Club. All bands 160 through 2 meters, so 6 and 2 meters included in this one, with the exception of the work bands. And it is sideband, CW, and FM mode as well.
And, well, we are out of time already.
It goes by quickly, as we always say. We thank you for tuning in for 30 minutes with us here every week on CKUT. We will do it again next week. We will put up links to a lot of our stories on the show on our Facebook page. And don't forget, you can go and catch the show again on the YouTube channel, which is International Radio Report. Thanks for tuning in. We'll do it again next week.
Don't.